90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
The only good Indian is a dead Indian.
Welcome to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Rhonda, your host here for the next hour. We're going to be having a special interview with Debbie Reese. So make sure you stay tuned for that interview as well. It's pretty warm out there, so make sure you're drinking lots of water. All right, we'll get started with the music. And some Thunder Hill. You're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
never spoken for the blood we have spilled, for the treaties that were broken, for the leaders you have still. Custer died for your sin. Custer died for your sin. Now a new day must begin. Custer died for yourself, for the tribes you terminated, for the myth you keep alive, for the land you confiscated, for our freedom you deprived. Custer died for your sin. Custer died for yourself. To die for yourself, for the truth that you pollute, for the life that you have cost, for the good you prostitute, and for all that we have lost. Custer died for your sin. Now a new day must begin. Custer died for your sin. Custer died for your sin. Custer died. Now a new day must begin. Custer died for yourself. Custer died.
Thank you for joining us here on Native Spirit Radio, here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Rhonda, your host here, and we have a special guest with us. That is Debbie Reese, who is an activist scholar who publishes American Indians in Children's Literature blog site. She's also from Nambe Pueblo. Thank you for joining us, Debbie.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, I really wanted to get into how did you get started with it's very specific in what you do and blogging about children's literature and how Native Americans are seen in that. How did you get started with that?
Back in the 90s, I was teaching at Santa Fe Indian School, and once got married and had a little girl and had been teaching elementary school too, so I had a library of books and really was into the interaction that happens between a parent and a child when they're reading. So that's what I wanted to study in graduate school, and moved to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana with that in mind. I was going to study family literacy as an area of expertise and study and all that. And I got here, and the mascot issue, the University of Illinois had a mascot that was a race-based mascot, Chief Lahaina Race. I was really taken aback by how deeply it was embraced and trying to understand why people thought it was so wonderful. And part of that included looking at children's books and noticing how often that stereotypical image is in much-loved books. So that was the turn in terms of what my research area was going to be. It moved away from family literacy to the representations of Native people in children's literature. And it proved to be a field with much mining to do in terms of length of history of misrepresentation and breadth of it, because it's ongoing, and also a very contentious area, because just like the mascot, there are people who love those images and think they're wonderful, and that those of us who object to them are being quote-unquote politically correct, and that we need to grow a thick skin and things of that sort. So in a nutshell, that's how I got to be where I am doing what I am doing.
What was one of the first books that you noticed that had inaccurate portrayals of Native people?
Well, before that, I knew about inaccurate portrayals mm-hmm. in children's books. But some of the ones that I recall from that early time period are specific to, to the experiences that we were having as a family. In particular, Brother Eagle, Sister Sky. I had come across that book, and I was analyzing it and talking about it, and my daughter was around when I was talking about that, so she was learning from some of my analyses too. And in her preschool, that I don't know what year it was, but she was the student teacher was going to read that book to the class, and she said, "There's something wrong with that book. It's not right." And this is, you know, she's 4 years old, trying to tell an adult there's something wrong with this book. And rather than say, "Okay, I'll put it away for now and I'll check with your mom," the teacher said, "Well, you don't have to listen to it. You can go over and, you know, sit over there." And so all the other kids got to listen to that. And so Brother Eagle, Sister Sky, with its misrepresentation of Seattle, was one of the first books that we as a family encountered in terms of its stereotypes and bias and misrepresentations of Native people.
And so your blog spot looks at different books that are being presented. Do you just look at children's literature and young adult?
Yes, I do. There are a lot, and this is an interesting question at this moment, because there are, I think we know, there are Native Literature Studies Associations, so there's more than one, where you have Native scholars studying the writings of Native people like Scott Monaday and Leslie Monansilco, these writers that we revere, that we know, that we talk about as adults. But there isn't the same thing happening with children's literature. For whatever reason, most scholars who are Native choose to study adult literature and not kids' literature. And I am one of the only people that is doing that consistently. There, you will find certain people will take up a subject like Harry Potter, for example, because that intersects with a film kind of media. And so Adrienne Keene writes about Harry Potter, the book and the movie, and she's more of a media scholar. So you see that kind of crossover sometimes. But I wish I could say, here's five other people who are Native scholars who are analyzing children's books. But I can't. And what I'm encountering right now, and this is part of why it's a problem, is that because I am the most visible, most vocal person doing that, the children's literature field of largely white people are saying, well, she's just one person. We need other people doing this, too, in a way that it discredits what I am doing. Mm. And so that's a problem that I'm in the midst of right this minute. And I just got so frustrated with it that I said, you know, this is like Trump, all these people who are saying, oh, we need someone else, and this isn't racist. Using tribe like this isn't racist. It's about a book, a new book that came out this year, and that will be in the running for the most prestigious medal. It's called There Is a Tribe of Kids, and the kid, it's a bunch of wordplay with the word kid and tribes, and other animals as well. But on the final pages, the kids are playing Indian, but they're not, it's a tribe of kids playing Indian. But they're using leaves, you know, leaves stuck in their hair, the way Indians put the, you know, the way Native people will have feathers in our hair for dances. It's a stereotypical thing, and there's nothing about Native people, but it can't deny that they're playing Indian. But everybody's denying they're playing Indian, and the tribe, word tribe there means, well, they could be Celtic kids. They're not Native kids. I'm like, oh my God! And so they're saying, see, well, has anybody else, has any other Native writer reviewed this book?
Wow.
And they ask it just like that. Has anybody else reviewed the book? So we can know. It's not just you. They say it like they're so sincere, and they're not. They're just trying to defend a very popular writer in a book they would love to see win the Caldecott. It's really frustrating.
Yeah, and so one of your, I guess, your biggest endeavors has been J.K. Rowling and the Harry Potter series. Why don't you explain to our audience, for those of them who may not know what's going on, what the problem was?
Okay, so she's well-known and much loved by many, many millions of readers, including my daughter, who when she was growing up, we read the Harry Potter books together. And it was interesting when we got to the last Harry Potter book, that one of the characters is looking in a box of photos, and there's a photograph, a woman in one of the photographs, and they think, huh, this looks like a Native American. And the way that the woman in the photo is described, it's very clear that J.K. Rowling was looking at that engraving of Pocahontas, where she's wearing that high silk collar. I think people might know what that one is, or they can find it. Pocahontas engraving, they'll find it. Anyway, that's what's described in that book, and I thought, wow, is she going to start talking about Native people now? When I read that, and there was nothing else in that particular book, but now she's launching a new movie and a new story that is set in what turns out to be Massachusetts. You know, early on, no one was sure where that was going to be set, other than somewhere in North America on the East Coast. Turns out to be Massachusetts. And this school, she has to provide the backstory for this film and the monsters that are going to be in this film. And what she's done is pick from several different tribal nations and some of the spiritualities of those nations and de-tribalize them, because she doesn't use their tribes. But they're becoming the beasts that are going to be in this new series. So that in a nutshell is what she's doing. And Native people were very anxious about that when they first saw the first peek into what she was doing back in March. There were lots of responses then, and I started curating them. And so I've got a page of over 50 different Native responses to what she was doing then, and it continues to the present, because every few weeks or so, there's more information put out there about this new school and these beasts. And so the responses continue. Now, the latest twist, or two later twists in this, are that a lot of us tweet at her on Twitter. So, because we know that she reads her Twitter account and that she responds to injustice a lot. So when something requiring a celebrity's thoughts on it, she'll do that. She'll step up and say, this is wrong, like Trump, this is wrong. She's stepping up on Trump, and she steps up on injustice for other people, too. With us, she's totally ignoring all of it. And a few days ago, she did take action. She blocked a Native writer who was tweeting at her about why her appropriations were inappropriate. So that's the latest twist. And another interesting twist on the whole thing is that there was this woman tweeted to her that she would like to be a professor in her school. And Elizabeth Warren, of course, is also in the news a lot, especially in Native circles, because of her claims to being Cherokee. So it's an interesting intersection of what people think they know about themselves and about Native people.
Definitely. We're talking with Debbie Reese, who runs, well, she considers herself an activist scholar who publishes the American Indian and Children's Literature website, where she looks at a lot of literature that's being written having inaccurate portrayals of Native people. So you're from Nombe Pueblo. Have you seen any books written about other Pueblos that have been inaccurate?
Other Pueblo stories that are inaccurate. Gosh, we are not a, we do get misrepresented in children's books. I have to I should do a blog post on a collection of those. But the one that comes to mind most quickly is Gerald McDermott's Arrow to the Sun. That came out in the 70s, right when the publishing industry was aware that we were coming out of the civil rights movement and that the world was too white and children's books were too white, and so the publishing industry was trying to get more books out there that were about people of color. And so quote-unquote folklore took off as a genre, and lots of books came out during that time period that were supposedly Native traditional stories, and they're not. They're white people's perception of traditional stories that they got from those old volumes that the Smithsonian's ethnographers did in the 1800s and early 1900s, where they had all these white people. And I don't say white people disparagingly. I hope people don't think I do. It sounds like that, I know. But where they had sent white people to reservations to gather our stories before we die. And those stories became parts of volumes that today's writers will turn to when they want to write a story or tell a story or retell a story that's mm-hmm. supposed to be about Native people. Well, those ethnographers were wrong is what they were presenting. They didn't understand what they were looking at, so there's layer on layer on layer of problem in using those particular collections. Anyway, Arrow to the Sun is one of those. It came out during the 70s in response to a call for multicultural literature. It misrepresents Pueblo people in pretty grotesque ways. The character, it sounds more like a Jesus kind of story, Immaculate Conception, because this girl has a baby, and he doesn't know who his dad is. It's the son, S-U-N, and he's got to go find his father. I'm not doing a good job of explaining it. It won the Caldecott Medal. It won that very, very significant medal when it came out that year, but it's got a lot of problems. It's presented as a Pueblo folktale, and part of what I say to teachers and librarians when I'm talking or writing about that book is there's 19 different Pueblos in New Mexico right now. We're not the same.
Yeah.
Take my particular Pueblo. What we do at the Upper Village is not the same as what we do at the Lower Village. There's difference in language, difference in shape of Kiva, difference in you know, I make the point that you can't have a Pueblo story because they're not the same. So that's one big one that that it is. You know, you'll find multiple copies of that in every public library, every school library.
Why do you think non-natives want to write a Native fiction children's book?
Why do they want to do that? I think it's kind of the same thing with this, you know, why do they want to embrace mascots, or why do they want to play Indian when they're at the Boy Scout camps and all those things? There is a very romantic character to how Americans today look back on American history, and I think there's this, oh, what we did was so bad. They were so wonderful. I have to tell people about how wonderful they were. I say that very sarcastically, but I think that's the mindset that is out there, is that that mascots honor and help us remember how wonderful Indians were, and that children's books, oh gosh, kids need to know how wonderful those Indians were back then. And so they incorporate that stuff into their stories, and then when we as Native people speak up about that, they say, well, you don't understand, or you're being picky, and all of that. So it's an interesting, like, they love us, but they don't want us.
Yeah.
in our lived experience today. They want their conception of long ago, far away, how wonderful we were, and that continues, and it's a huge problem.
Do you find any backlash against you, like when you go, I know you travel a lot to different conferences, do you have people who speak up against you when you're trying to educate others?
Oh, all the time. All the time, people are always objecting. One of the things that I fiercely advocate for, and maybe fierce is not the right word to use, but adamantly maybe, is that I want teachers and librarians to use books that are written by Native people. And there's a lot of benefit to that. The one is, take for example, there's a children's picture book called Jingle Dancer by Muscovy writer Cynthia Lightick-Smith. It's about a little girl who's going to do the jingle dance for the first time at a powwow. I wish I had that book when my daughter was doing the bow and arrow at home for the first time, because it's about how a family comes together to help a little girl get ready to do that dance, from helping her with her clothes to teaching her the steps and the song, all of that. And it's set in the present day, so she's watching TV. She's walking down the street, the character in the book. So when I'm working with teachers and librarians, I say, this is why you need to use Native writers, because you can say, Cynthia Lightick-Smith is Muscogee. That verb is critical, because it tells all the kids that who are listening to you that Native people still exist. And then you can go on and say, and Cynthia's tribe is over here. Here is their website. And you can show that Native people are using the same technology everybody else. So that's one reason. Clearly, a Native writer is going to give their experience in life, in their stories. So there's that sense of accuracy and authentic storytelling that's part of who we are as people. So that's one. But the second is the opportunities that it presents to teacher are incredible in terms of what they can do with a book by a Native writer. So when I do that whole bit, then invariably somebody will raise my hand and say, I'm being racist because I am saying, don't read this book, use this book. And I'm trying to censor all these non-Native writers and their books by advocating for Native writers. And that's not what I'm doing. I'm an educator. I'm trying to move the field of education and publishing to a different place, which I think is a good thing. But there are invariably people that call that word censorship. And as soon as you say the word censorship, then most people will shut down and say, oh, yeah, he's right. That person's right. Debbie's a censor. So the resistance is massive.
Yeah. Do you find libraries are more willing to heed your advice and get more Native written books in their children's libraries now?
I think it's a mixed bag. It would be hard to quantify that. I think that in my personal experience, there is a larger segment of librarians now who are interested in that and are making choices to purchase books by Native writers and not to purchase ones that are problematic or to discard ones that are problematic. And a major shift in the field is that the American Library Association various committees that oversee children's literature and children's book awards are incorporating language into their guidelines now that says, you who are selecting books for your library, you who are on award committees, need to understand that you have bias and ignorance and should reach out to X, Y, and Z, and one of the places they say go see is my website and my writings, to understand what you don't understand, to expand what you know. So there's a shift in the professional practice and the guidelines by a powerful entity, American Library Association. But there's still a lot of resistance out there. So I guess it'll take another, I don't know, 2 decades for us to see where we are at that point. The thing is, we've been through this cycle more than once already. In the 60s, we went through this, and there was, oh, yeah, we need to have books by Native writers. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of these white books by white writers that are bad. We've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
So my hope is that with social media, a new tool, that we are reaching more people than we ever have before, and that it is making a difference. So we'll see.
Definitely. So who are some Native children's writers that you would suggest that our parents or even libraries get within their collections?
On my website, if you can put a link to my website
somewhere
in your show, there is a tab of best books. So there you'll find, I don't know how many, lots of pages of links where I've discussed books that I really like. Some are like Jingle Dancer by Cynthia Lipchick Smith. Others include books by Louise Erdrich, who is Ojibwe, and has a series of books that are a response to and a terrific alternative to Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, wow.
Erdrich, so in that one, people don't realize that three times in Little House on the Prairie, someone says, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And when I'm working with teachers, I say, can you imagine, here's a picture of my daughter when she was eight. Read that line out loud. Just do it. And they're embarrassed because they think, well, I really can't do that. And yet they do it all the time. Mm-hmm. If I'm not standing there by them, they're imparting a lot of hurtful language to the Native children in their class who may or may not, quote unquote, look Native. That is one problem in Little House on the Prairie. The series that Louise Erdrich did, the Birch Bark House series, now has four or five books in that series, and it's the same time frame, you know, during the historical fiction, during the time when Europeans were spreading out across North America, and with Little House on the Prairie, it was Manifest Destiny. With Louise Erdrich and the Birch Bark House, she's way more thoughtful in how she's presenting that whole period of history and its impact on a family. So I highly recommend that instead of Little House. So she's one. There's an illustrator up in Canada, because I do work with First Nations literature as well, Julie Flett, F-L-E-T-T, who does beautiful work as an illustrator and a writer. So I highly recommend her. She does a lot of her books in Cree language as well as English, and she's one that I like a lot. Eric Gansworth is Onondaga, and he's got a book called If I Ever Get Out of Here that is really terrific for kids who are in 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grades around there. So I like that one a lot. And one of the very cool things about his book, but in Eric's book, he presents Native for a part of our life. So the kid lives near the border of Canada. He's going to go to Canada for a concert, and he has his tribal passport, you know, his tribal ID, and they're going to cross the border, and so it's a white family that's taking him over there, and he gets to talk about what this is and why this matters. So there's this well-told bit of history in that book that kids who are from there will go like, yeah, here we are, this is our story in a book, rather than naked Indians shooting white settlers kind of story.
Yeah.
That is way too common. So that's good. And one that I also like very much is Tim Kingle's How I Became a Ghost. He's Choctaw. And the very first chapter heading for chapter one is Choctaw Nation. And I think that's a first for me to see the word nation as a heading in a chapter for a children's book. And I really want to see a lot more of that, because that's what sets us apart from everybody else in the country in terms of minority populations. We are nations, we're sovereign nations, and that is really missing from children's literature.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Debbie Reese, who's an activist scholar who publishes the American Indian and Children's Literature website, and we appreciate everything you do. I really enjoy your tweets. I mean, you keep me on my toes, because sometimes there's stuff that goes by that I don't see. And you can follow her on Twitter and find her on her website as well. Just really enjoyed talking with you today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, so that was our interview with Debbie Reese. And like I said, you can find her at American Indians in Children's Literature www.blogspot.com. And she has a wealth of knowledge on her website, where you can find her best books, and she does it by year. So, and then best books for elementary school, best books for middle school, best books for high school, best board books, as well as 2014, and she's working on 2015 as well. Like I said, she keeps us on our toes about stuff going on, because I guess I look at books. My office is located in a library. I've worked in a library before, and so I've seen bad books. I've seen the book with what's his name? The crying Indian. Who's that guy? I can't remember his name. The guy who cried. But he wasn't even Indian. And he did like a sign language book, and we had it at the Haskell Library. And I remember pulling it out and looking at it, and I'm like, "What? Why do we have this in our library? Like, this is ridiculous." And I actually brought it up, like, going through and maybe looking at books that shouldn't necessarily, because at Haskell they divide it with Indian collection and then the other collection, which all the Indian collection is supposed to be Native American books about tribes and everything. And I was wondering, like, we even had stuff that was written by wannabes, and so I was like, maybe we need to go through and move it to the other side. So I don't know if they ever done that or not. But Debbie was tweeting the whole time during her interview, and she sent me a tweet to another book that she thought was just really bad with Pueblos, and this one was called Season of the Two Heart, published in 1964 by Lois Duncan, and it was about a Pueblo girl who leaves her reservation to spend her senior year in Albuquerque to attend public school. She lives there with a white family. In return for room and board, she will take care of the two younger children and other chores. So in some of the stuff Debbie was talking about, was saying Duncan had to make Pueblo life unattractive and unappealing, and for readers, she had to create sympathy and support for the girl's decision. That's terrible, having to see that type of stuff being put out there, and that was in the 60s. So hopefully this person is not writing any more of that. So yeah, it's pretty crazy. All right, we'll get back into the music. I am not doing news today, just because we had that interview, but I hope you guys understand. So we'll get into the music, and this is Dear Native Youth. You're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
I wrote this song for you, cause I wanted you to know that I put my heart into. I get inspired every time that I speak to you. I can acknowledge all the things that you're going through. And trust me when I say that I've been in your shoes. Locked up before for breaking all of the rules. I felt alone, so I posted up in my room with thoughts of suicide. I don't know what to do. I'm so confused. If I end it all, who's gonna care? Picture my funeral, who's all there? That constant feeling of despair. Zoned out with a blank stare in that moment. I'm trying to decide my fate with war paint written all across my face. The ancestors fought hard and never gave up this easily. So I find something deep inside of me. To my dream or your family, thanks for believing in me. Together with the you, we gon' make some history.
Line.
Dear native youth, yes, I'm still talking to you. I promise you, owing the truth, that's all I know how to do. Too many years of constant being lied to. I know how you feel. You probably had it up to here. And take a moment from wiping the stairs. Close your eyes for a second. Imagine you no longer living in fear. Keep your head above the clouds and know it gets better from here. Pretend for 1 second, Pop's putting down a beer as he puts arms around you so you can feel how love heals. How love heals. How love heals. It's not your fault that love for your life, it just disappears. It disappears. It disappears. I know the pain suffocates and takes you to a distant place. A youth among all experience the highest rate. We got a promise, we will never let the youth fade away. This is more than Twitter hashtags, dear native youth. Native youth.
know you'll never find another man that can go
way, way, way.
That's how I know you'll come crawling back to me again.
Underwriting support for KKFI is provided by the 2016 Kansas City Fringe Festival at kcfringe.org, July 21st through the 31st, an 11-day performing and visual arts extravaganza, linking the two worlds of mass appeal and eclectic taste together to inspire and entertain, featuring cabaret, comedy, dance, film, music, spoken word, theater, and variety. More information is available at kcfringe.org.
Hey, this is Grant Conrad, and I want to talk to you a second about KKFI's Vehicle for Charity program. Do you go repair after repair on your vehicle? You fix one thing just to find another thing is broken? Well, you can actually do a tax-deductible donation of that vehicle to KKFI. All you need to do is call Bill at 816-994-7869. That's 816-994-7869.
All right. Thank you for listening to Native Spirit Radio this Sunday. And it's about my time to be getting out of here. And Sunset Reggae will be coming up next. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Again, thank you to Debbie Reese, who was on doing an interview with myself. And her website is American Indian American Indians in Children's Literature.blogspot.com. Make sure you go check it out. You can also find her on Twitter as well. So I'll see you guys again next Sunday. Make sure you stay hydrated. It is really warm out there. I'll be leaving you off with some Cheever's Topa and some Native American church music.
Hey, yo, and they ho, hey, yo.